Hello everyone, this is Mike Quincy, Connecting the Light. I've got a slightly different program because the first half will cover an interview which we're doing live here with Bob Schwartz, and he's an author who has recently published his own book called Courageous Souls. It is about the pre-birth claims of people who have allowed for experiences through pre-life planning. So, Bob, welcome to the program. I wonder, having introduced you, if you would like to expand upon that and tell our listeners what your book is about.
I'd be happy to, Mike. The full title is Courageous Souls, Do We Plan Our Life Challenges Before Birth? And as the title suggests, the book explores the premise that we are all eternal souls who plan our lives, including the quote-unquote bad things that happen to us or the challenging things, before we're born for purposes of spiritual growth. So for many people, this is a new concept and a bit of a radical concept, but I've been researching the topic for almost 4 years now, collaborating very closely with several very gifted mediums and channels who are able to access information about people's pre-birth plans. In fact, one of the mediums actually has the ability to see and to hear the pre-birth planning sessions we have with each other. And so the book contains actual conversation from those pre-birth planning sessions. And in the book, I examine life challenges like physical illness, having handicapped children, deafness, blindness, drug addiction, alcoholism, losing a loved one, and severe accidents. And I interview people who have experienced these challenges. And then we have sessions with the mediums in which we ask Spirit, did this person plan this challenge before he or she was born, and if so, why? And then the book presents the answers that came up in those sessions.
Right, yes. Right. So just developing that on one particular type of disability, I can't imagine something that can be more difficult to deal with than deafness. I mean, blindness is one thing, but at least you can see what is around you. Can you tell us anything about what you found out about someone carrying that type of disability?
Well, in Courageous Souls, the story about deafness is a young African-American woman named Penelope. And working with medium Stacy Wells, we go into Penelope's pre-birth planning session, and we find out there that in a previous lifetime, in fact, in the life immediately prior to the current one, Penelope had the same soul as her mother, as she does in this lifetime, but in the previous life, the mother was shot to death by the mother's boyfriend. And Penelope was a young child when this happened. She heard the gunshots. She didn't actually witness the murder, but she heard the gunshots. And as you can imagine, she was quite traumatized by them. So in the pre-birth planning session, she expresses to her spirit guides that she would like to heal the trauma from the previous lifetime. And the guide, her spirit guide asks her, my dear, would you like to be born deaf, so that the healing that needs to occur can happen more on a subconscious level and you won't be distracted by the sounds of the material or the physical plane? And Penelope says, yes, this is what I would like to do. And so she chooses deafness as a way to heal from the previous lifetime.
Yeah. Now, did you establish in speaking with the soul of these people whether some of these lives went back greater periods of time? You mentioned that this particular one was the immediate life beforehand. I mean, is karma held over for many lives until there is a more suitable time?
It is. One good example of that is in the chapter on death of a loved one. In that chapter, I talk with a woman, Valerie, who in this lifetime lost a fiancé 48 hours after they got engaged, and she also lost her only son, Dustin, when he was a teenager, to an accidental drug overdose. And we do something very interesting in this chapter. One of the mediums I work with, Corby Mitlead, has the ability to channel a person's soul. So Corby channels Valerie's soul, and this gives me the rare opportunity to interview a soul directly and ask, were these two deaths planned by Valerie before birth, and if so, why? And what her soul tells us is that she and the fiancé and her son Dustin had been in many, many different lifetimes together, playing out different themes of love and loss, There was a particular lifetime 1,500 years ago when Dustin and the fiancé were members of a raiding party, a primitive tribe that attacked and killed another tribe. And so we get an explanation of how this karma has been carried over into the current lifetime.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very much what you said. It goes back many lives.
Yes. Well, that's interesting because I would guess people hearing about this would rather assume that what you carried in this lifetime was probably more likely to be associated with your last life, it being sort of an ongoing thing that you handle very quickly. So that seems quite a time ago, doesn't it?
Well, my sense of how it works is that souls choose different themes to work on in different lifetimes. And so you could pick up on a theme that was from many, many lives ago, or you could pick up on a theme that was from just one or two lifetimes ago. It'd be entirely up to the soul.
Oh, I see. You actually get some degree of choice here, then.
Yes, and I don't think it's possible or even desirable for a soul to work on everything or even most of the themes in any particular lifetime. So souls like Valerie, for example, they'll work on a theme of love and loss in a number of different lifetimes, but in those lives they may choose not to work on other themes that have to do with different past lives.
Yes. Right. So when this sort of pre-planning was taking place, are other souls of, say, a higher wisdom involved, or is it purely on a one-to-one basis with one of their guides?
Well, much of the planning takes place among the soul group, and for listeners who are not familiar with that concept, a soul group is a collection of souls who are at approximately the same evolutionary stage. Typically, they incarnate with each other many, many times in many, many lifetimes, and they will script all sorts of different roles. So, for example, Mike, you and the other souls in your soul group, these souls would be your parents, they would be your children, your friends, spouses, they would be mortal enemies. You would play every conceivable role with these other souls in your soul group, and by doing that, you would develop qualities like empathy and compassion and a more profound self-knowing that would not be possible if you didn't play all those different roles on the physical plane. Now, the soul group will also work closely with spirit guides, and sometimes there's an involvement of ascended masters and other highly evolved beings, but most of the planning is among the soul group with the collaboration of their spirit guides.
Yes. Well, that's very interesting. Would you say that this happens necessarily with every person before they incarnate?
I believe that it does. If there are exceptions, I haven't found any yet. Now, having said that, The planning is different for different souls. Some souls have very firm plans. They have very specific ideas about what they want to experience here. And so the planning is done as a high probability. Then there are other souls who have more open-ended, free-flowing life plans. And the planning is done more in terms of possibilities, leaving more room for the free will of the personality to navigate through the lifetime.
Right. Again, we're seeing how the variables come into this. The cases that you actually selected for your book, I guess, are the most extreme ones. But did you find in the process of probably doing this exercise with any number of people that there were many who had sort of minor disabilities? I mean, you picked out the more extreme cases, I assume.
Well, there are some extreme cases in the book, but what I really tried to do was pick out the most common types of life challenges, and that's why there's a chapter devoted to physical illness, which is something that almost everyone will experience at some point. There's another chapter devoted to the death of a loved one, another universal experience. One of the more extreme cases is there's a story of a woman who planned before birth to be in a bomb explosion. She was working in her early 20s as an administrative assistant at a college in Southern California. She went to her employer's mailbox to pick up the mail, and a pipe bomb exploded in her face. And that was an experience that she planned with the bomber before she was born. It's a very powerful story because this is a woman who wanted to be a healer in this lifetime, and she felt she could be the most powerful healer if she went through an experience like that and healed herself first. And as it's turned out, that's exactly the way her life has gone.
I think some people will be very apprehensive about accepting that you actually, as in that case, make some pre-plan with the person who's going to take your life. It almost sounds impossible, doesn't it?
Well, you know, I think the important thing to keep in mind there is that the way this looks from the perspective of the personality is very different from the way it looks from the vantage point of the soul. From our perspective as human beings, something like a bomb explosion seems like a very terrible event. But from the soul level, you have to keep in mind that a lifetime is extremely brief. It's, you know, it lasts about as long as a clap of thunder. And all of the suffering that's in a lifetime is extremely transient. No one is permanently harmed by it. There is nothing that can permanently harm you.
Indeed.
All we're doing really is enacting roles on a stage. So, you know, to feel like the bomb explosion is a tragic event, it, from the perspective of the soul, that would be as though characters who were in a play in which a bomb exploded actually believed that the bomb was real. It's not. It's just part of the script. And the same is true in this woman's life.
Yeah. And, of course, when we're on Earth and something like that happens around us, it does seem more devastating to us, doesn't it, when we're still down here?
Well, you know, Mike, the reason I wrote the book and wanted to bring this information to people is that so often when something, quote-unquote, bad happens to us, we see no purpose in it. It just appears to be meaningless suffering, and because it appears to be meaningless, the suffering is made worse. I know, speaking from personal experience, when bad things happened in my life, I sometimes thought, you know, if I could just see some deeper purpose to this, the suffering wouldn't be nearly as bad. And Courageous Souls is really an attempt to give meaning to suffering that appears to be purposeless. And I think when we see meaning in it, the suffering is lightened. And in addition, we can go about learning the wisdom that the experience offers in a much more conscious manner. And frequently people find that feelings of guilt and blame and anger are replaced by forgiveness, acceptance, and peace. Yeah. I think that's the real value of the research.
Right. So now, in the long run, what is the purpose of these experiences in what is known as duality? Where does it lead to?
Well, my understanding is that the spiritual realm that we come from is very much as it is classically portrayed. It's a realm of great peace and joy and love and light. And in such a realm, we as souls experience no contrast to ourselves. And because we experience no contrast to ourselves, we can't fully know or understand who we are. So we come to the earth plane, this realm of duality, you know, hot, cold, up, down, right, left, good, bad, because here there's plenty of contrast, and it's the contrast that leads to a more profound self-knowing. For example, I believe that souls by nature are intrinsically loving and compassionate, but in the spiritual realm there would be no contrast to our loving natures. There would be no contrast to compassion. So a common life plan that I describe as a learning through opposites plan would be for a deeply compassionate soul to incarnate in a dysfunctional family in which this person will be treated with a lack of compassion. And that lack of compassion forces the person to look inward to their own compassion. And as they rediscover their own compassion internally from the soul's perspective, this results in a more profound self-knowing. Now, again, there's suffering that's involved, and from the level of the personality, we may think that the suffering is bad, but from the soul perspective, the suffering is extremely brief and transitory, but the more profound self-knowing that comes from experiencing contrast becomes a part of the soul literally for all eternity.
Now, just getting back to you personally, at what point in your life did you realize that this was going to be part of your life plan?
Well, I started researching Courageous Souls in May of 2003, and what happened at that time was that I was working as a freelance marketing and communications consultant, and I was very unfulfilled by my work and by my life. I kept thinking that there must be some higher purpose or higher calling for me, but I had no idea what this higher purpose might be. And one day, I decided that I would try to find out by having a session with a psychic medium. Now, I'd never done anything like this before, but I thought I would give it a try. And it ended up changing my life, because in this session with the medium, I was introduced to the concept of spirit guides. I previously had not known about those. And I was able to talk with my spirit guides through the medium. And they told me that I had planned many of my most challenging experiences before I was born. So, of course, I said, well, why in the world did I do that? And they said, you plan these challenges for purposes of spiritual growth. So in the weeks that followed that session, I kept thinking about that, and it struck me as a very powerful idea, because I was able to go back and look at all these quote-unquote bad things that had happened and completely reframe them, and suddenly they took on a new meaning that I had never seen before. And I thought, people should know about this concept of pre-birth planning, because it could have the same effect on their lives as it was having on mine.
Yes, indeed, So I guess as you easily took to this idea, you must have had quite an open mind beforehand.
Well, I've always been very spiritually inclined. And but what happened was, at about the same time that I had the session with the medium, I started to have certain metaphysical experiences of my own for the first time in my life. And those experiences really opened me up to believing in and considering the non-physical realms. For example, I started to see the outer edge of my own aura, which is something I had never been able to see before. And I had another experience where I was just walking down the street one afternoon, and I was suddenly overcome by this feeling of unlimited, unconditional love for every person I saw. You know, the cab driver sitting behind the wheel with his car waiting for a fare, the mother pushing a baby in a stroller down the street, the barber cutting hair behind the window of his barber shop. Every person I looked at, I had a feeling of overwhelming love for them. Even though I had never had an experience like that, I understood immediately and intuitively what was happening, which was that I was in enhanced communion with my soul. And it's as though my soul was saying to me, this love is who you really are. And I believe that that experience was a gift from my soul, because, you know, in the book, the central theme in the book is that we as souls are love, and we come to the physical plane to express love and to experience ourselves as love. And if I had not had that experience on the street one day, I would have still come to that conclusion based on my research, but in the back of my mind there would always have been a little voice of doubt wondering whether or not that was true. But because of this experience, I know from firsthand direct encounter that it is true, and I believe that's why my soul created that experience for me.
Now, it's obviously set you on a path here that could lead to greater things, shall we say. I know it's early days yet, and you're probably, I guess, planning to do some sort of touring or to try and get the book widely advertised. But are you already thinking in terms of doing a follow-up?
Yes, actually, a lot of the research that I did for the first book will show up in the second book. And I'm very interested in hearing from people who would like to share their stories in the second book. I would ask your listeners to go to my website. It's www.courageoussouls.com. And there is a contact form there. There are also email links at the bottom of each page. And if anyone is interested in being interviewed and sharing their story in the second book, I'd like to hear from them. You would have an opportunity, if you're selected, to work with the mediums and find out about your own pre-birth plan. So, again, the address is www.courageoussouls.com.
Right. Now, are you actually saying that you would like people of a similar disposition to the ones that you have in your book? You're just looking for additional examples?
It could be anyone who has faced really any type of major life challenge. I'm not going to cover the same types of challenges as I did in the first book, but let me say this. It's not necessary for the people in the second book to be firmly convinced of the reality of pre-birth planning. That's not a requirement for participating in the research. You simply have to be open to the concept.
Yes, right. Yes. Well, that's very interesting. I must say, in my time, since I've become interested in these types of subjects, and I'm an avid book reader, I don't think I've ever read something that quite tackles the subject the way you have, and I haven't come across anybody who's had this opportunity to interview the souls of the people that you're dealing with. I think it's quite extraordinary.
Well, I feel very blessed to be called to do this kind of research, because it's made an enormous difference in my life in the way that I look at my own challenges, and has made it really possible for me to completely accept and forgive in regard to those challenges. And, you know, earlier in my career, I was a journalist, and I, of course, interviewed people in body, and now I interview not only people in body, but many consciousness who are not in body. So it's really sort of a new and interesting type of journalism in a way, and
yeah.
I just feel very blessed to be able to do this kind of work.
Great, yeah. I can see your pre-planning actually sets you up very nicely for the work that you've just done. I mean, being a journalist, obviously you were quite adept at writing a book. You had that background, so that worked out wonderfully well. But of course, it was meant to, wasn't it?
Well, in addition to that background, one of the things that was most interesting to me is that the woman I described to you earlier, Christina, who was in the bomb explosion, when we go into her pre-birth planning session with the medium, I was quite startled to find that I was there, and she and I had a conversation in which we talked about this book that I was going to write, and I asked her if I could tell her story of the bomb explosion, and she agreed. So she and I planned before we were born for her to tell the story in Courageous Souls.
Yeah. It's all very wonderful and very mysterious in some ways, isn't it? I think it's great. How many, is it a very big book? How many pages is it, Robert?
It's 327 pages. And it's,
wow, that's pretty big.
Again, it's available on CourageousSouls.com. It's also available on Amazon, including Amazon UK. And you can also order it through your local bookstores.
Right, that's brilliant. Just a word about your own publishing. Was that a matter of cost, or did you have difficulty in getting it published in the first place?
Well, the book is self-published through my publishing company, Whispering Winds Press. And, you know, this allowed me to have creative control over the project and make sure that the end product was the quality that I wanted it to be.
Yeah. Well, the cover looks very good, I must say.
It looks very
professional, which it would, of course.
We should tell your listeners that the cover is a beach scene at twilight, and it shows a path of footprints leading down to the water with planet Earth above the water on the horizon, conveying the idea that a soul has walked along that path and incarnated on Earth.
Wonderful, yes. Well, I couldn't quite see that detail on my computer, but that's interesting, yes. But look, it's very wonderful to have you on the show, and it's an extremely interesting story. Perhaps after a certain period of time, we must have you back again and find out what's developed. Is this offer that you put out to have more people contact you with a view to sort of taking this idea a bit further already open now? I mean, are you looking for people that are willing to be interviewed already?
Well, I'm collecting the names. I haven't started the interviews for the second book yet, but again, this would be a good time for people who would like to interview to contact me through CourageousSouls.com, send an email or use the contact form, tell me just a little bit about yourself and your life challenges, and then we'll go from there.
That's brilliant, yes. And of course, I will mention on your behalf that you do have an email newsletter that goes out approximately once per month, which people can subscribe to. And I believe you have an order page where they can order the book direct from you, and you also have a telephone facility as well. So they've got two options there.
Yes, all that information is on the website. Also on the About the Book page on the website, there's a free PDF download that contains a large sample of the book. It has the table of contents, the preface, and a large portion of the Death of a Loved One chapter. It's completely free, and I would encourage people to download that if they want to read a sample of Courageous Soul. Right.
Okay. I did want to do that prior to our interview, but I think there was a little hitch, and I couldn't actually download the PDF version. But I will go back and have a look at that. Well, I think we can say that the interview has been very interesting and successful. What I'd like to do now, Robert, is conclude it. Thank you very much for making your time available to come onto the program. And as I say, perhaps in the near future, perhaps I could contact you again to find out what you're up to and how your book sales are progressing.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you very much for coming on the program.
Thank you. I'd love to come back sometime.
Yeah, you will be very welcome indeed. Thanks again, Robert. All the best and all the best of success in the sale of your books. I think you deserve it. It's a very, very interesting subject. I think it should go well.
Thank you, Rob.
Bye then.
Bye-bye.
Right, hello, everybody. I hope you found that very interesting.
Yeah,
what I will do for the... Sorry? What I will
go
do
ahead.
For the... Are you still there, Robert?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm here.
Gone yet? Yeah,
no,
okay.
I'm here.
Right. Okay, are you going to clear the line now, then?
I can hear you, Mike. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you. Yeah. Are you staying on the line, or are you clearing now? I mean, are you staying on for the program, or?
I can stay on the phone if you want me to. Otherwise, I can hang up.
Well, I think it might be preferable if you were to hang up, actually. Yeah, it's been delightful to have you with us. Who knows? You might get some direct response of inquiries from our listeners. I hope you do.
I hope so, too.
Okay.
Thank you again.
Thanks again, then, Robert.
Okay, take care, Mike. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye, then. Right, hello, everybody. Back again. For the second half of the program, obviously I'm restricted in the time I've got to cover the normal subjects. So what I will do is read out the weekly Sheldon Ider report on behalf of the Spiritual Hierarchy and the Galactic Federation. Then I've got various news items which I suspect will enable me to close the program. As usual, the message from Sheldon Ider is very uplifting, so I will commence, and it reads that they are returning with more information, and, quote, our Earth allies continue with the wrapping up of those tasks that are to bring your promised prosperity funds. Now, I'll stop there because a number of people obviously are familiar with the Nasara, and I think what we're talking about here, although the name isn't used quite so often, is actually those benefits that have been promised under the name of Nasara. It goes on to read that also those elements of the American government covertly assigned the most difficult mission of ousting the present illicit administration are finally ready to carry out this task as soon as the necessary preliminaries are over. Now that has to be good news, because the idea of announcing Nasara and the benefits of it have been, shall we say, floating around for quite a few years now. And I know it will be giving a lot of pleasure and help to a lot of people who have been in dire need, I think, of the financial help that will come following the activation of the Nasara benefits. The report goes on to say, moreover, we can report that the mechanisms are in place to move fiscal responsibilities from the Federal Reserve to the Treasury, and that the new Treasury Bank is now actually operational, albeit under camouflage. Indeed, the fiscal and currency policies of the American government have temporarily been bifurcated into an overt operation, that is the Federal Reserve, and a covert one, which is the Treasury Bank, the latter being secretly in charge of most key fiscal pronouncements. The exceptions to this new arrangement are so-called anti-terrorist decrees coming directly from the White House. The ongoing secret struggle has reached the point where the removal of this US regime is the only workable option. To accomplish this global mission, set up special Earth Ally task forces outside of the US with headquarters in Europe and in East Asia. These three bases are linked by a high-tech communication system supplied by the Galactic Federation, which allows everyone to talk to each other, engage in conference calls, and send important data streams outside the interception range of the world's intelligence agencies. This assistance has greatly helped the mission to stay on course by being able to set up the code criteria needed to carry out this project successfully. We are confident that the first series of steps is very close to manifesting in your media. That this entire operation has remained both clandestine and efficient is an emphatic tribute to those brave souls who deeply believe in what they are doing. This will permit your world to alter, which will then allow us to be formally introduced to you. First contact becomes more viable every day because of their steadfast activities. We ask you to stay patient and in favour of their complex and difficult undertaking on behalf of the peoples of your world and us. A key aspect of our mission so far involves support and encouragement. We gladly lend whatever experience and expertise our Earth allies may need. We also brief on a weekly basis elected representatives of your world's governments on those aspects influencing your readiness for first contact. First contact requires that those who rule your world become fully aware that this event is not only inevitable, but also quite close. Further, your world requires a steady diet of serious warnings about the destructive use of nuclear energy, especially since the dangers of the present nuclear age can so easily be converted into peaceful use. Also, many suppressed technologies seized by various governments under the vow of national security can be returned to the world to end your current energy crisis. The continuing refusal of your governments to do so appalls us. If your government so wished, your poverty and pollution problems could be permanently solved. This makes it essential to implement as soon as possible the splendid lineup of programs drawn up by our Earth allies to enable you to be ready for our arrival. First contact, above all, is a psychosocial phenomenon, closing the gap between where you are at present and where you need to be for this event is a continuing task for us. Preparing you for this new reality will require a great deal of preliminary training. You're on a path composed of mandatory, interrelated steps set out by heaven and the divine plan. As your consciousness grows, your search for answers about the meaning of life spirals upward and opens you up to possibilities that previously would not have occurred to you or that you would have considered illogical. Now, however, your expanded body of knowledge allows you to rethink many of your most cherished precepts. This has led to many of you accepting the fact that we do exist and that we are here to complete a divine mission based on benevolence and the desire to tell you about the wonders of full consciousness. We thank the divine for this wonderful plan. This plan is proceeding at a pace designed to allow you, as a global population, to adjust to a great deal of change. The complex web of control and manipulation set up by the Anunnaki and then reinforced by their on-planet minions will require extensive recasting. It includes your history, philosophical and religious beliefs and your myriad cultural conditionings. Such sweeping change in the short period allowed us is no easy matter, and yet the process already underway is the aegis of the divine and is wondrously preparing you for what lies ahead. We watch carefully as heaven alters your RNA, come DNA, introduces new chakras into your physical energy systems, and opens you up to new mental, emotional, and spiritual prospects. These things raise your ability to perceive us as your long-forgotten family, in spite of the foolish propaganda spread by the world's mass entertainment media. The key is to keep focused on what you know is truly going on, rather than be distracted by erroneous offerings. Our operation relies on your growing acceptance that a great change is underway. This inner knowing of yours enormously aids our cause. Your scrutiny of our presence reveals to you that our actions are not merely benevolent, but beneficial to Mother Earth and to you. This growing realization lies at the core of the proactive paradigm shift in favor of first contact. Each day we see this movement gaining more adherence across your globe, and this evidence of your acceptance of us sincerely touches our personnel. First contact is to deliver you to the next level of your conscious existence, and it is in this state of beingness that you will be able to interact with those sentient beings who reside beneath you, in inner earth, and in the untold vastness of the galaxy that surrounds you. First contact, in short, represents a level of attainment in your growth in consciousness. It is a sign that you have graduated from your present reality's limitations to a higher and more expanded one. In accordance with this, we tailor our contributions to support, in all ways permitted to us, your current development, which the divine is now exponentially accelerating. This means that this next step is approaching rapidly. Your destiny is to soar over your present troubles and to forge a galactic society of some consequence. This society is destined to lead us to things that have long been prophesied by many of our more illustrious forebearers. And it is this, amongst other things, that inspired us to dispense with the usual protocols and to sanction this present, unique first mission. Your first contact has reached the moment where it is to be manifested. Events are moving fast to free you from a series of overwhelming disasters most of you consider to be inevitable. But contrary to appearances, you as a species are not on the brink of dying, but on the point of return to your full consciousness. The crucial point here is to keep seeing your true and glorious future and not to lend any power to the dark desire for your demise. Those now in power on your world know for a fact that their game is up and are frantic for you not to discover this truth. Be aware that this next period can dispirit you if you let it. Instead, be in joy in the knowledge the time comes to slip into the reality of your great potential now manifesting. As spring follows winter, you are fated to burst into the bloom of who you truly are. And thereby ends this week's message, again very uplifting. One senses that first contact is exceptionally near. My own estimation is that something like that could happen, perhaps in 3 to 4 months. But these matters are very fluid. And of course, what we don't know at this stage is the ultimate date which is set for it to take place. And I'm referring to the one that has been given by divine decree. It's not, of course, one I know, or to my knowledge, one that has been revealed. But we do know that there is a point beyond which matters have to change. And as I said, I think the impression is that it's not very far away at all. Now, I'll come now to a number of items that I've got on what I call my general news. Quite a lot going on this week in one way or another. And the one I read today really, in a way, brought a smile to my face. And it shows you how originality or trying to get on with your problems yourself without bothering other people can actually lead to trouble if people want to make it that way. I read an article which was written by Huey Freeman. It was local news from a website, herald-review.com. And it was talking about David Wetzel, who was 79, who was surprised to hear a knock on the door at their Eastside home while he was getting dressed. And two men in suits were standing on his porch. And they showed their badges and said they were from the Illinois Department of Revenue. And Wetzel said, come in, maybe I shouldn't have. One of the agents, Gary May, introduced himself, that is a special agent, and the other man, John Egan, was introduced as his colleague. And May gave the Wetzels his card, stating that he is the senior agent in the Bureau of Criminal Investigations. David Wetzel's wife, Eileen, said, I was afraid. I came out of the bathroom. I thought, good God, we paid our taxes. The check didn't bounce, did it? The agents informed the Wetzels that they were interested in their car, which was a 1986 Volkswagen Golf that David had converted to run primarily on vegetable oil, but also partly on diesel. Now, Wetzel used recycled vegetable oil, which he picks up weekly from an organisation that uses it for frying food at his dining facility. The agents told David Wetzel that he required to have a licence and he was obligated to pay a motor fuel tax. And Mr. May also, he said, told me the tax would be retroactive. And since the initial visit by the agents on January the 4th, the Wetzels have been involved in a struggle with the Illinois Department of Revenue. A couple who live on a fixed budget have been asked to post a $2,500 bond and threatened with felony charges. That's quite a little story, all told, but I mean, you get the basis of what is happening there. You've got someone who's being economical with the use of their car. I guess it's certainly bordering on being a non-polluting type of fuel. And of course, it's cheap and it's saving the energy's fuel. It's only one man and his car, but nevertheless, to be pilloried in that way because of his inventiveness amazes me. You'd think the people would have much better things to do. No doubt that story will come and go. Next one I have here is one relating to the Public Campaign Action Fund. Most of my information comes through emails that are sent me. Sometimes I go onto the sites, but most comes to me that way. And the question was asked here as to why President Bush was firing corruption investigators. And unfortunately, as happens so often, I don't quite know where this original story came from. But it reads as follows, that in recent weeks, a series of news stories have emerged that paint a disturbing picture. The Bush administration has systematically removed U.S. attorneys who were leading corruption investigations into public officials. And it's stated that it's happened as many as 8 or 9 times. So what it's asking in this article is for people to write to their senators and representatives to demand that Congress get to the bottom of this story and insulate U.S. attorneys from political interference. Among other tasks, United States attorneys are responsible for investigating and prosecuting elected officials for public corruption. And the report says, as you can imagine, these investigations are at once politically charged and critical to the holding government, who is accountable. But in recent months, the Bush administration has replaced U.S. attorneys like Carol Lam of San Diego, who put Duke Cunningham behind bars. So, they're saying, take action now to prevent these firings from continuing. Write to Congress to ensure that U.S. attorneys can do their jobs to root out corruption, regardless of partisan politics. And that email came my way on the 7th of March, and I don't know whether the report came out on the same day, but the what I have here is concluded by saying that hearings start today in Congress to get to the bottom of these stories, and former U.S. attorneys from all over the country have been subpoenaed. And it says quite correctly, it is critical that Congress hear from you that continued political interference won't be accepted. I'll just have a sip of water before I read the next one, because I find I'm getting a little bit of a croaky voice here. I don't know why. Just bear with me for a few seconds. Right, I'm back with you. I just hope that's eased it a little bit. Another report I have here comes from the website called timesonline.co.uk, and it's talking about America's most senior military commanders and saying that some are prepared to resign if the White House orders a military strike against Iran. And that apparently is according to highly placed defense and intelligence sources. And it reads that tension in the Gulf region has raised fears that an attack on Iran is becoming increasingly likely before President George Bush leaves office. And this report evidently comes from the UK paper, the Sunday Times, which is saying that it has learned that up to five generals and admirals are willing to resign rather than approve what they consider would be a reckless attack. There are four or five generals and admirals we know of who would do so, said a source with close ties to British intelligence. And it was said there is simply no stomach for it in the Pentagon. And a lot of people question whether such an attack would be effective or even possible. The British defense source confirmed that there were deep misgivings inside the Pentagon about a military strike. All the generals are perfectly clear that they don't have the military capacity to take Iran on in any meaningful fashion. Nobody wants to do it, and it would be a matter of conscience for them. And the final comment was, there are enough people who feel this would be an error of judgment too far, and there would be resignations. That's interesting, isn't it? You see these different lines of possibility that could ultimately bring Bush down. Another one I have here, which comes again from a UK website, which is politics.co.uk. A report that came out on the 3rd of March relates to something that's been going on in the UK for a few months now, and that's regarding the Cash for Honours inquiry, which has been instigated by the Attorney General. I thought you might just be interested in that, because even our own government here has problems. And apparently Lord Goldsmith, who's one of the key people involved in the inquiry, obtained an injunction from the Royal Courts of Justice an hour before the BBC was due to broadcast an item about it on their 10 o'clock news. And the BBC came back and claimed the story was a legitimate matter of public interest, whilst the Attorney General's office insisted that the decision to seek an injunction had been made completely independently of government and in cooperation with the Metropolitan Police. I gather that a few days after that, the BBC was able to report this story, and what it basically came down to was they were able to identify two people over some rather dubious messages that passed between them, which would throw some light on this scandal and might have well implicated one of the people involved. So there you are, just a minor thing really, but it's all about wealthy political donors, which in return for cash loans used to fund the campaigns during the 2005 general election, would expect to be given peerages. Oh, there we are. Kashran, as they call it. I have here an article, again came to me by email, which originally came from the truthout.org website, another very good site. It was dated the 2nd of March, and it was by Declan McCullough, and that came off the CNET News, and it was reading that the Bush administration has accelerated its internet surveillance push by proposing that websites must keep records of who uploads photographs or videos in place, police determine the content is illegal and choose to investigate. CNETnews.com was the source of that information. That proposal surfaced, which must have been a week ago Wednesday, in a private meeting during which the US Department of Justice officials, including Assistant Attorney General Rachel Brang, tried to convince industry representatives such as AOL and Comcast that data retention would be valuable in investigating terrorism, child pornography and other crimes. The discussions were described to News.com by several people who attended the meeting. The second purpose of the meeting in Washington, D.C., according to the sources, was to ask internet service providers how much it would cost to keep record details on their subscribers for 2 years. At the very least, the companies would be required to keep logs for police of which customer is assigned a specific internet address. Only universities and libraries would be excluded, one participant said. There's a PR concern with including the library, so we're not going to include them, the participant quoted the Justice Department saying, we know we're going to get a pushback, so we're not going to do that. So there we are. I thought for some time that there's so much freedom on the internet that you could bet your life that the government or some of its organisations would want to somehow exert some control. I can certainly see the value of trying to track down people that deal in child pornography or other crimes, but you have to think that when Big Brother can get hold of that type of information about you, it is inevitably used for other reasons which perhaps you wouldn't kindly agree to. So that's something else that seems to be developing. Of course, the big news this week has had to be about the Libby trial, and it's worth mentioning it again in an article that came off that good site I just mentioned, truthout.org. And I will read it because maybe not everybody knows the ins and outs. But apparently, day by day, witness by witness, exhibit by exhibit, Patrick Fitzgerald, the prosecutor in the trial of Dick Cheney's man, Isla Scooter Libby, is accomplishing what no one else in Washington has been able to do. He has impeached the presidency of George W. Bush. Now, the article reads, of course, it's an unofficial impeachment, but it will also, through its documentation, be inerasable. The trial record, testimony, exhibits the lot. And they will all be there in one place for investigators, scholars, reporters and Congress to pore over. It goes far beyond the charges against Mr. Libby. It is instead a roadmap to the abuses of power that Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney and their shadow government of neoconservatives had committed as the neocons carried out what they had been planning for years, an invasion of Iraq and other military excursions for the purpose of expanding American dominion. From the start, when he was named special prosecutor in late 2003, Mr. Fitzgerald seemed to understand and embrace this much wider significance. Yet he was careful not to overreach, crafting the indictment of Mr. Libby narrowly. He had lied to a grand jury and to FBI agents about leaks. He had given his favorite media people to discredit the vocal critic of the war. And of course, that was former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who had included in his work in Africa, was asked in 2002 by the CIA to investigate unconfirmed reports that Saddam Hussein had recently tried to purchase 500 tons of yellow-caped uranium as part of the refining to produce nuclear weapons. Anyway, that was proved to be false, and I've really covered the point of reading that extract. It is something that might not well have come to people, and that is the unofficial impeachment of George W. Bush. I feel it's another factor which may well grow and could be another reason why Bush will ultimately be removed. So I'll leave that one there. I think most people otherwise know a lot about the Valerie Plame case. That's been going for quite a long time. Now, another one that's come up is related to, trying to see what the sources are something on here. Oh, well, it's a flashback anyway to New York City's anti-terrorism efforts to go high-tech. I can't see where it originated from, but it seems it's possibly come from a daily newspaper. Anyway, it says that the Facilities Command Center is on the 23rd floor of a building, and its walls are reinforced with withstand wind gusts of up to 160 miles per hour. It's also bulletproof and bomb-resistant with its own air supply, and an 11,000-gallon water supply and three backup generators. Now, they class that as being part of the 9/11 subject. And what they're getting at is they're saying bomb and bulletproof, and the official story is that fire brought it all down. Although no steel-framed building had ever collapsed from fire to 9/11. And I see now they're talking about WT7, and they're saying also, did the sprinkler system work or kick in? If not, why not? There you are. There's another point. 9/11 never really goes away. Almost on a weekly basis, you read more comments or things that have been found out about it. So evidently in WT7, on the 23rd floor, was this massive command centre that shouldn't have been subjected to what it was, apparently. Interesting. It evidently proves that there must have been some mighty explosions to demolish that building and such a heavily constructed floor of that nature. I have a report here from NOLA.com. It's talking about energy. And a claim that had been submitted for a staggering $77 billion. And it's talking about the city of New Orleans that joined tens of thousands of would-be plaintiffs who rushed to beat the Thursday deadline to alert the Army Corps of Engineers that they may sue for losses resulting from the Levee breaches after Hurricane Katrina. An article written by Michelle Kruger. And they're saying that joining this queue were Energy New Orleans, the city's bankrupt electrical utility, which was seeking $655 million, and the New Orleans Sewerage and Water Board, which put in a claim of about $460 million. So while they are likely to be amongst the largest filed, the three claims became part of an avalanche of paperwork that poured into the Corps' Leak Avenue headquarters. That was a week ago Thursday. So there we are, some ongoing problems resulting from New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina. Amazing, isn't it? And I gather that they still haven't tackled all the problems resulting from that hurricane. But I'll have to end on that note. I had one or two items, but they'll live for another week. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Robert Schwartz. Very interesting man, and I think his book deserves to get a lot of publicity and sell very well. Thank you for being with me. I hope you'll be with me next week, and may I say, God bless you all. Thank you.